Hey, you're listening to the Words on Flick Show with me, Janine Coveney. You're listening to the Words on Flick Show on eWater Radio, KEWR-DB.
The views and comments expressed do not reflect the opinions of eWater Radio. All comments and views are show guest views and comments and in no way reflect views or comments of eWater Radio, KEWR-DB, or its affiliates.
Hey there, Words on Flicks fans and friends. It's your girl Janine Coveney with another edition of the Words on Flicks show, this time for July 2022. And last month, I had a wonderful show where I invited a lot of different journalist friends to talk about their dads for the Father's Day edition, and that went over quite well. But in the months before, I had done shows where I focused on films about certain cities, and of course, we focused on New York and Los Angeles. Well, it's time to focus on a new city, and this time, it's Chicago. Chicago is a city that I've visited several times on business, although not recently, and I always found it to be a city with a big, big heart. It's good eating, it's a lot of culture, people are certainly devoted to their city, their hometown, with good reason. There's a lot of Black history there taking place there, political history, cultural history. It's a city known for its music, for jazz, for electric blues, for house music. And of course, in the not too distant past, wow, a century ago, during Prohibition days, it had a reputation for gangland crime, mafia activity, bootlegging, and the like. And Chicago's a tough town, man. They don't take no guff there. So I was happy to get a very special guest along with me to talk about it. Demetrius Patterson, also known as D.E. Malik Patterson. He's a journalist, newspaper columnist, and he joined me late last year, I think it was November, when we were talking about issues of authenticity in the film The Harder They Fall. So this time we're going to talk about his hometown. So he had some great picks for films set in Chicago. And of course, we couldn't talk about all the films. But what I really loved about our conversation is that as a Chicago native, Demetrius was able to bring up a certain hometown's perspective to our talk, where he was able to really break it down about the history of Chicago, facts about certain neighborhoods, culture, and certain aspects of the films that really reflected what Chicago is about. So take a listen to our talk about Chicago films.
Chicago is home, right? Like born and raised.
Yes.
South side. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's why I thought you would be the perfect person to do this podcast.
I will say this. You know, Chicago always, as you mentioned, they had a reputation of being that prohibition, that gangster Al Capone, John Dillinger era, and then some of the rougher parts when we had projects here, which all those have pretty much been torn down, which were mainly in the area called Bronzeville. It's Chicago's Harlem. That's the best way to put it. And there was a project on the north side, really next to the Gold Coast, the wealthiest part of Chicago, called Cabrini Green, which
everybody knows Cabrini Green.
Right. And that's where, matter of fact, one of the movies we're going to talk about tonight, Cooley High, that was based out of that project. And the TV series, Good Times, the Evans, they lived in Cabrini Green. A lot of people don't know that Curtis Mayfield is from Cabrini Green. I know we're talking about movies, but for me, like, he's the greatest all-around soul legend. You know, his songs are so prolific, and he's a genius to me. And a lot of musicians in the know, be it, you know, R&B, rock, jazz, a lot of them agree with me. So that kind of is dear to my heart. But Chicago has always kind of had a reputation of being, and this is different than, say, racist, although it had its racist elements, but it had a reputation of being very segregated. But segregation wasn't really, it wasn't necessarily all a bad thing. Segregation in Chicago meant, you know, okay, yeah, African Americans pretty much lived in their neighborhoods, and, you know, mostly on the south side, the west side of Chicago. But you also had a section of Chicago called Bridgeport, which mainly Irish people lived in. That's where the, like, the Daleys, who were the Mayor Daley and then his son, they were like the two longest term mayors in Chicago. And then there's like a little Italy. There's a section up north that's mainly where Polish people live. And my understanding is that Chicago has the largest Polish population outside of the capital of Poland, which I guess is their main city, Warsaw. Yeah, it's a huge Ukrainian population here. So it's a section of a community called Ukrainian Village in Chicago. Mm. So that's how I was segregated. But then you had, on the north side of Chicago, you would find people of different ethnicities and cultures living together, because the north side of Chicago probably feels more like New York, where the south side, the west side kind of has more, doesn't really have a lot, except for those projects that were here. They don't have a lot of high-rise buildings. It's mostly single-family homes or something we might call a two-flat or a three-flat. But on the north side, that's where you find most of like the high-rise, I mean, you know, like 20, 30, 40 stories or more, you know, and people are more condensed. And then in a part of the south side called Hyde Park, which is where the University of Chicago is, and that's mainly Jewish people live in Hyde Park, but that's also kind of like the more bohemian. That I always try to give an equivalent to New York. That would be more like a village. So that's kind of the look of Chicago. Now, with that said, kind of going on a topic at hand to talk about a few movies that I thought represented Chicago.
So you can get started on the topic and talk about your first movie. So here you go.
Okay. I guess the first movie I would probably talk about, because I think it really, in some ways, put Chicago on the map and made people interested and also wanted to find out more about the city's music scene or a certain genre of music, which is blues. And that would be the 1980 movies, The Blues Brothers, with John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd.
Ma'am, you got to understand that this is a lot bigger than any domestic problems you might be experiencing.
Would it make you feel any better if you knew that what we're asking Matthew to do is a holy thing?
You see, we're on a mission from God.
And I think what was so special about The Blues Brothers is that it really showed the beauty of the city from various communities, because they shot the movie downtown, they shot the movie up on the North Shore in the area that where unfortunately we recently had the mass shooting, I should say. They really made use of the South Side. They did a lot of shooting in the South Side. For example, I can think of the scene with Ray Charles in the pawn shop. He was singing I can't remember what song he was singing. But it hit a lot of dancers in the street. But that was like in the heart of Bronzeville. And even though I didn't grow up in Bronzeville, my family church was like just a block down. And I just remember just, you know, we were watching the camera set up and much younger than, you know, and we're just really excited that they're making a movie in Bronze. Because Bronzeville, unlike now it's kind of going through a gentrification, kind of like Harlem has, but back then it was kind of, you know, a blighted community. That in the 1920s and 30s, though, it was like the place to be, like Harlem, you know. That's where all the African-American celebrities, sports figures, actors, politicians lived in Bronzeville, you know, and then it went down. But anyway, so Bronzeville, excuse me for this, because it's probably not politically correct, but this is what the area was called, where Aretha Franklin did her music scene. I think she did You Better Think. But that was in the area called Jewtown. this was kind of like the area where a lot of people in the city would go and buy like clothes for the school or for definitely for Easter. And a lot of the like clothing shops and tailors were owned by Jewish people. Mm-hmm. So they called it Jewtown. Mm-hmm. And also where you mentioned the Good Eat, it was famous Polish sandwich place. You know, you had to stand up and, you know, stand in line and get it. But Maxwell Polish, where we, you know, Chicago style Polish sausage, just, I don't know if, I'm sure you've heard of that when you were in the city. And then it also ventured into the far south side and some of the suburbs where, like, a lot of workers, especially African Americans, because a lot of African Americans from mainly Alabama and Mississippi, especially Mississippi, were part of what they called the Great Migration. And they moved to Chicago. They went from Memphis to Chicago and the southern suburbs just south of the south side of Chicago. There were a lot of steel mills and blue-collar factories, and that's how many families made their living, you know, worked there and dreamed of a better life for their children and grandchildren. Oh, and I would be remiss if I didn't mention, of course, all the blues legends that Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi exposed to the world, you know, in the Chicago style of blues through that movie. Only I can remember John Lee Hooker. I can't remember all the blues guys' mm-hmm. names. I don't know. But it was a lot of Chicago blues legends there. And it just really, I think that movie really kind of was the first film to put a spotlight to the different looks and the feel of Chicago, you know. Remembrance of that when that movie came out, that black community, they loved the movie. Now, Dan Aykroyd is from Canada, but he woodshed at Chicago has a Second City improv theater. And most of the comedians and actors with the Saturday Night Live came out of the Chicago Second City improv theater. And for John Belushi was from Chicago. Well, he was from the North Shore area. I'm not sure if he was from Highland Park, but if he wasn't, he was like from the area next to it, Lake Forest, you know. But anyway, he grew up in that area, so they had a connection to the city, and you know, and that they weren't outsiders who didn't know anything about the city. I mean, we really felt that it was because of those two that it showed Chicago in such a beautiful light, you know, it was almost like a love letter to Chicago. With blues right. music undertones or overtones, if you will, you know. And of course, the black church can't forget about yes. that. It really put the spotlight, the spirit, and the movement of the black church with the James Brown scene. I think Chaka Khan was in that scene too. So that's very South Side, is Baptist or Pentecostal church like. So.
Mm-hmm. Even though I think the characters of Belushi and Aykroyd were actually trying to save a Catholic orphanage, I think.
yeah.
They kept calling the nun the penguin. That's what I remember as well. But it really is. It's a great music movie. It's funny. It's got a lot of great star turns in it from all these musical acts. So in that sense, it's a really great showcase for Chicago. So thank you for sharing that. And, you know, that was on my list of Chicago movies as well, but I knew you wanted to talk about it. So let's see, where do I go after that music thing? Well, I think I'm just going to have to jump right to the John Hughes canon. It's not necessarily musical, but, you know, John Hughes, the director, writer, producer, was known for his teen comedies, movies in and around Chicago. So those include Pretty in Pink. He wrote Home Alone, 16 Candles, The Breakfast Club, Weird Science, and Some Kind of Wonderful, which is also a movie that I really enjoyed. But I think the most quintessential, well-known Chicago movie out of his canon has to be Ferris Bueller's Day Off. So even though John Hughes, made his bones making all these comedies, mostly set in the Chicago suburbs and kind of capturing the mindset of kids, teens, and the young adults sort of wrestling with how to adapt to the adult world. So in Ferris Bueller, the main character, who's played by Matthew Broderick, he's this wise-ass, wise-cracking kid who decides that, you know, he's getting ready to graduate from college, but he needs, like, to have, like, an adult adventure. He doesn't want to go to school, so he takes his girlfriend Sloan and his best friend Cameron, and they just take his best friend's sports car and go for a day in Chicago. And if you didn't know anything about Chicago, after you watch this movie, you have seen most of the Chicago downtown institutions, right? You get to visit the Art Institute of Chicago. You know, they go to a baseball game at Wrigley Field, the Sears Tower, the, I think it's called the Mercantile Exchange. And then they wind up in this German-American parade, which I found out is called the Von Steuben Day Parade. Now, which is like the biggest German-American celebration that they have in Chicago. But actually, the timing is off because they set it sort of at the end of the school year, but generally Von Steuben Day happens in September. It's actually super popular in New York and in Philly. Like, wow. I did not know this. Just in researching this, I found this out. So it's really a great love letter to Chicago, and that was John Hughes' intention. The movie is hilarious. I mean, it's like a wise-ass film. It came out in 1986. It also has Jennifer Grey before the nose change. It's got Jeffrey Jones, who is a hilarious character actor as the supercilious principal. Charlie Sheen is in it. Edie McClurg, which is not a name that people necessarily know, but if they see her, they know her because she's hilarious. She's like the glue-sniffing school secretary. And then you have, like, Ben Stein, who's an economist who's in the movie as that teacher that everybody knows that line, Bueller. So to me, this is, like, the quintessential Chicago movie for a certain generation of young people. And while I wasn't the age of Ferris Bueller, like, I, you know, look, in 1986, I was a married woman, believe it or not.
Wow.
Yeah, I can still relate to a lot of this stuff. And just a Chicago side note to this movie was another sort of teen fun gone wrong movie that came out a little bit earlier, which was 1983's Risky Business, which is a breakout film for Tom Cruise and writer-director Paul Brickman. So that one also has comedic moments, but it's definitely not a comedy the way Ferris Bueller is. But you have like this high school, this high-achieving high school senior who gets entangled with a prostitute and has to resort to running his own brothel out of his parents' house while they're gone to buy back all the expensive belongings that the girl's pimp burgled from the house, right? So that is a cautionary tale, but it's also a very Chicago movie in the sense that it is filmed in the suburbs. And then you have, like, every teen boy from that era's favorite scene when Tom Cruise has sex with the call girl on the Chicago L train to this moody Tangerine Dream music. So there's two Chicago movies right there. So those were among the ones that I could think of smart-ass young high school guys growing up in Chicago.
Did you mention Home Alone?
I did mention Home Alone. It was filmed in Highland Park.
Yes, it was. Yeah. Most of John Hughes' movies were filmed in Highland Park or Lake Forest, which is the community just north of Highland Park. I mean, that's a great review of those movies. And you really painted a great picture of Chicago as it related to those films or how those films try to portray Chicago. But just quickly, what I was going to add, I graduated from Loyola University in Chicago, in the city of Chicago. But before I transferred there, I actually went to school in Lake Forest. So for a couple of years. So Lake Forest, Highland Park, Winnetka, Wilmette, and probably most people will have heard of Evanston. They're all in an area called the North Shore. The North Shore is probably the wealthiest suburban area of Chicago. And I just thought one thing those films always did, especially the teenage angst or Ferris Bueller or the John Hughes movies, and it was true. Like, for those teenagers or young people who grew up in that area, Chicago was almost like the forbidden land, you know. So they wanted to come into the city, but it was probably usually against their parents' wishes, you know, because they felt, you know, that, oh, you're going to, you know, although the city was way safer, you know, back then than some of the stuff you hear now. And that doesn't mean that the city is not safer than what we won't get political, what you hear a lot in the national news. It's still, the city's still full of tourists, and I feel very safe, and I live in the heart of the city. But anyway, yeah, the young people, you know, it was kind of like coming into adulthood. You know, you would go into the city, you'd go to various new wave clubs or venture into house music, different dance clubs, and get into all kind of mischief. Then you find your way back to the North Shore. So I kind of feel like that's what those movies kind of try to convey.
All right. Thank you for saying that. Well, in the interest of time, I didn't go into the whole John Hughes canon because I wanted to talk about some other films, and I know you have some other films you want to talk about. So what's the next film on your list?
I guess my next film would be the 1975 film, Coolie High, which starred Lawrence Hilton Jacobs, and many people would know him as Freddie Boom Boom Washington in the hit television series, which I think started in the same year, actually, Welcome Back, Carter. And then one of Aretha Franklin's former husbands, I don't know when they were married, but probably after this time, but Glenn Turman. Lauren Hill's director, he played Cochise. Right, and Glenn Turman played a character named Preach. And they were like best friends and who attended Coolie High, which was a real high school. I think it actually closed down in the late 70s or early 80s. And this film was based on the friendship of these two high school buddies in Cabrini Green, ironically. And we had mentioned Cabrini Green earlier. And the interesting thing about the project Cabrini Green is that it was really a project that was right on the edge, if not in the middle, right on the edge of the city of Chicago's richest community, the Gold Coast. So mm-hmm. just north of downtown, and this was like people in Chicago who were like, we're not even talking about upper middle class, we're talking about upper class, old money, you know. Mm. But they had this project there, and it was almost like an island, you know. But these kids, sometimes they would venture out the projects, you know, and go downtown or try to get a, you know, they might steal a car and joyride on the north side of Chicago throughout the Gold Coast. And that's kind of what's the spirit of this movie, just kids getting into mischief, although it kind of had a sad turn, you know, with one of the main characters running from high school bullies and they beat him up and, you know, they take his life. But what I got out of the film, well, first of all, it was one of the first films that I saw that showed a significant love story between the Glenn Turman character, and I can't remember the name of the young lady who played his girlfriend in high school. But prior to that, you only saw, like, I wouldn't say love, just more like sexual things going on in black exploitation movies. That was like the big thing then. But Coolie High kind of like turned the corner there. I think Coolie High actually opened a door so that we could see films like Love Jones, or films more about families and friendships, and not just, you know, violence and gangsters and pimps and stuff. Coolie High turned that corner. It grossed over $13 million. So that's a lot of money for a film in 1975.
Yeah. It touched a lot of people's hearts because it was sort of, because it was also a throwback movie. It came out in 1975, but I think it was, even when it came out, it was looking back to the 1960s.
Yeah,
because
you're
there was a lot of Motown music, and people were sort of watching it and reliving their own high school years, the you know, the dances, the house parties, the red light parties,
exactly.
And, you know, ditching school and, you know, just getting into teenage mischief, and also how, particularly for young black men, what could be seen as mischief in Chicago or any other big city could easily turn into life and death, you know?
Yeah.
So also it gave us so many great songs, and it was such a heartthrob movie that song, you know, It's So Hard to Say Goodbye, that came at the end.
It's so hard to say goodbye to yesterday.
Yeah.
Just resonated for generation after generation of people.
Mm-hmm. And it's also with the film of hope, you know, because the friend that survived, you know, they kind of did a little montage. I guess you call it a montage at the end of what happened to the characters, you know, and that character went on to become a famous Hollywood writer.
Man, you know, sometimes I'll be walking down the street and sitting around, and I look up, and I expect to see you coming around the corner. I hear your voice calling my name or something. I almost expect you to go to Hollywood with me. I know. Hey, don't worry, man. I'm going to make it. I can lie and steal too good not to survive.
He got out of Cabrini Green and moved to Hollywood, and, you know. So it was like, yeah, even with tragedy, there's always some hope, you know, some sunlight that will come out somewhere, you know. And the most tragic incidents in a person's life, it could be the catalyst in helping them or giving them the will to move on or push on, to go in life where, you know, where they always aspired or dreamed to go. And so I thought that film was kind of in that vein.
And that is significant, especially for Black audiences, because ours is always the story of triumph over adversity and, you know, trying to make something out of nothing. And so that character of Preach, even though he was looked upon as being corny or nerdy, I think a lot of people, male and female, identified with him because he was still able to be friends with his friends who weren't as bookish as him, and he held on to his dream. And it's a profoundly influential film in terms of its structure, its casting, the things that happen, and the music, and it is Chicago to its heart. All those scenes at the L, which I think of as being Chicago, and
Lincoln Park Zoo. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
So much beloved. So thank you for bringing Cooley High to us. So I think you mentioned, as you were talking, you mentioned how it sort of paved the way for Love Jones. So let me just say a couple of things about Love Jones.
Who am I? Well, they all call me Brother to the Night. And right now, I'm the blues in your left thigh. Trying to become the funk in your right. Is that all right?
So Love Jones came out in 1997, which means that this film is 25 years old.
Oh, wow. Wow.
That don't even seem possible, but it is possible. I feel like this film is important, and I know that a lot of people love this movie, too. Although we don't hear too many people talking about it. It only occasionally comes on TV. But this is a really important film in terms of tracking a contemporary love relationship and talking about not only the love relationship, but there's a lot in the movie about Black culture and how Black people deal with one another, some of the hurdles that they're dealing with in corporate America. So it's personal and professional. And, you know, just how Nina Mosley and Darius Loveholes, who are the main characters played by Nia Long and Lorenz Tate, they are artsy, fartsy Chicago professionals. Like, he's a writer, she's a photographer. They meet cute at a poetry slam, which at the time was you know, one of those things that black people were doing to be hip, and Chicago is one of the hippest centers of African American cultures. But the film is also really exceptional because you can feel the sizzle between these two people, right? You can really feel it. And that's what I love about it. I'm not somebody, you know, I've watched a lot of romances and stuff. I'm not, yes, I am a woman, but I'm not a huge fan of romantic, like, rom-coms. And, like, sometimes they just seem too contrived. But I do feel this movie, the fact that their romance unfolds through these events that we recognize, the spoken word club, the friend's house party, the badly timed exes showing up. But, they go dancing, they go to the reggae club, and it just, the setting is part of what makes it interesting. And the fact that one of the characters, I think she is trying to decide whether she should take her career to New York. So you have that interesting dichotomy between, you know, these two major cities where New York has more of a media profile than maybe Chicago does. And she's trying to decide, you know, whether to choose her career over love and what she should do about that. So it also has some great music as the soundtrack. I don't know if it's specifically Chicago music, but it's great music. And it's also got some really good second banana appearances, like Lisa Nicole Carson is in it. I just loved her. I know she's had maybe some, I don't know, I guess mental health issues over the years that have kept her from being on screen. And it's also one of the first film performances by Isaiah Washington. And so, you know, Isaiah Washington is the guy best friend, and, you know, the Lisa Nicole Carson is the girl's best friend. So that you have these best friends who are chattering in the main character's ears about that woman ain't S-H-I-T, or that guy ain't, you know, why y'all gonna get together? They ain't gonna amount to nothing. You know, is he doing the right thing? Is she doing the right thing? So the characters are also trying to overcome this Greek chorus of it ain't gonna work out, which kind of reminds me of another Chicago movie, which I keep linking these movies together, about love between white characters, which is About Last Night, which was Demi Moore and Rob Lowe. So I used to love that movie for a while. I'm not as enamored of it now, but that was another super Chicago set movie about two people trying to come together amid the blah blah of all their friends saying, it ain't gonna work. It ain't gonna work. It ain't gonna work.
Right.
So I don't know if you're familiar with that movie, but
Love Jones. But I was gonna say one quick thing about Love Jones. I think I agree with you that a lot of the music wasn't necessarily represented the sounds that were coming out of Chicago, but I would venture to say, I think if it wasn't for Love Jones, I think it made the black community more receptive to artists that would come not long after that movie, like Jill Scott, you know, because of the spoken word and the poetry was sung, even though it was in a different language, but I'm thinking of Les Nubians. And then the group that, the British group that they wrote Butterflies.
Floetry.
Yeah, Floetry, thank you. What I'm saying, I think it helped open the door for the genre, the style of music we come to know as Neo Soul. That's really what I want to get at. I think that was one of the films that kind of, you know, because I think Love Jones did have a huge song by who I consider a Neo Soul artist, Dion Furris.
Yes, a penny with a hole in it.
Yeah, which was written, I don't know if you noticed, but that was written by Halle Berry's current beau, who I think he's like one of the most underrated black musicians. R&B rock musicians, you know, so Van Hunt, he wrote
I
that song.
I love Van Hunt. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's kind of what I get from the film Love Jones.
That is a very good point, because there was also jazz, classic jazz, on that.
Oh, In a Sentimental Mood, John Coltrane.
Yes.
John Coltrane and Duke Ellington.
Yes, Duke Ellington. Yeah. And Michelle and Dayo Cello is also on that soundtrack.
Yes, yes. I'm going to mention one real quick. I don't have a lot to say about it, but I had on my list a 2002 movie called Road to Perdition.
This is the life we chose, the life we lead. And there is only one guarantee. None of us will see heaven. Michael could.
Which starred Tom Hanks, Paul Newman, and as a nasty, nasty gangster, Daniel Craig, who was our last James Bond. So this is like basically a gangster movie. I'm not going to get too much into the storyline here, but it was a gangster movie and set in 1931, Chicago. Actually, it was in Rockford, Illinois, but I think a lot of the action happened in Chicago. But why it's on my list is because a lot of the film was filmed in Chicago in a southeastern section of the city called Pullman. And Pullman is a community in Chicago, which is kind of, the whole community is like a historical landmark. Back in the early 20th century, like, you know, 1920s, there was a railroad company called Pullman, and most of their porters were black. And the owner of the railroad company, Pullman, he built, I can't think of his first name, I'm sorry. He built this community for his employees, mainly black employees, but it was white employees also. But he built this community on the far south side of Chicago, built houses, row houses, grocery stores. It was like a self-contained community. So all the money spent that the employees spent went back to the Pullman company. But that community still stands. A lot of the houses built back in the early 1900s are still there, you know. And the filmmakers of this movie, Road to Perdition, they filmed a lot of the scenes in that area. And I remember that area is not too far from where my dad was living at the time. I had just moved back to Chicago in 2001, like just months before 9/11. And my dad lived in that area. And I remember visiting him, and I went down, I had to drive through the community. And for blocks and blocks, I just saw like cars from the 1920s and 1930s parked all over that community. I'm like, what is going on here? I didn't see any cameras or anything. But then I found out later that they were filming the film there. And that's the magic of the city of Chicago, too, I think, is that it's easy to take the city. It still has a look of different eras, you know, especially within the early 20th century, you know. But still, like, it still has the era with the brick streets or cobble streets. I think we even have some wood streets in some of our areas downtown that survived the Great Chicago Fire. But that's what I take from that film.
Okay. So you bring up what I mentioned at the top of the show. I mean, The Road to Perdition is a really great film. But it also reminds me of what we were talking about, the gangster history and Al Capone and Dillinger and all that stuff. So I feel like I should mention The Untouchables.
Oh, wow. Because, great film.
Yeah, really great film that a lot of people love, from 1987. I did say that a lot of my Chicago films are from the 80s. And so the film is directed by Brian De Palma, which to me is a little bit surprising, because Brian De Palma films usually are a little weird or kinky in a way. And there's nothing kinky about The Untouchables necessarily. But it stars Kevin Costner as the real-life crusading agent Elliot Ness. You know, he's trying to take down the gangster and chief bootlegger Al Capone, played by Robert De Niro. And I don't even really like Robert De Niro in that role, even though he sort of transformed himself physically. To me, the whole film is about Sean Connery, who plays, it's like one of his last big film roles, where he plays this Irish cop who's helping Elliot Ness along with Andy Garcia and Charles Martin Smith. Charles Martin Smith was like this nerdy guy in American Graffiti, but there's a lot of great set pieces, like moments of great tension in this film as Ness and his Untouchables are trying to do battle with Al Capone's henchmen. They're trying to find a way to take him down, and they finally do it through his unreturned tax returns. But Sean Connery gives this great iconic speech about it's the Chicago way.
I want to get Capone. I don't know how to get him.
You want to get Capone? Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
You know, which
Obama reversed that, though. Well, she said, you know, if they go low, you know, you go higher. And I just thought that was funny because she's from the south side of Chicago, you know, that she kind of took a different spin of that. But one thing you were saying about the director, you know, and his, like, the weirdness of his films, but his way of directing really made that one iconic scene in Union Station with the baby buggy. I mean, that's like, if anything, people really remember from that movie, they remember that scene.
Yes, and I actually have it in my notes about those tense scenes where, you know, Elliot Ness is in Union Station and trying to save this baby, and they're in a shootout with, you know, these gangsters. And also the scene where he's running over the rooftop from the courthouse to chase Nitty and
Hitman.
A lot of nail biting sequences. So in that sense, it's a really good film. I mean, I like Kevin Costner, but I feel like he's sort of the same in a lot of roles. Like he doesn't really have a lot of emotional range. I like him anyway, but you know, he's not what impresses me about this movie. But it is a really good movie in the sense that you're getting yet another film about the Chicago gangster prohibition era. And there were so many films from the 1930s and 40s and 50s about gangsters, either about Al Capone or Al Capone-like gangsters, and about some of his cohorts and, you know,
John Dillinger,
and that whole prohibition era and the speakeasies and just that whole thing just continues to fascinate people. And, you know, it's hard to shake that legacy.
Well, I was leaving work. I saw a big bus that said Chicago Gangster Tours or whatever. So tourists on the bus. So, yeah, that unfortunately, that legacy is still. And the bus was packed. It was a tourist bus, you know. So, yeah, a lot of people still come to Chicago for that, you know.
As a side note to that, you know, there's the musical Chicago.
Chicago's hottest dancing duo. Come on, baby, why don't we paint the town? And all that jazz, I'm gonna rouge my knees and roll my stockings down. And all that jazz.
Which was set in the 1930s, and it's really about the cynicism of the, you know, about crime that set in. Like, people were so jaded about crime and reading the paper, and you know, you could be a scandal could make you be a media star one day. You murder somebody, like these women, you know, Roxy Hart murdered somebody, and so now she's a media star, she's a sensation, and the next day all of that could go away. And I think that's an interesting comment to come out so early in the, you know, set in so early in the 1900s about Chicago's cynicism about that era of prohibition and gangster crime and murder and, you know, tabloid journalism and all of that, you know?
Yeah. Right. I mean, Chicago is a very political town. I would venture to say that. He would say it, too, because I've interviewed him a few times, you know. But I don't think that could have been a Barack Obama if he hadn't come to Chicago, you know, because it has that climate. It's that hotbed political petri dish, if you will, that he needed to be in, you know, and to grow, learn, you know, what he might face, you know. if he was going to succeed in his ultimate dream, which, of course, he did, you know, becoming president of the United States. So, and Chicago has always been that, you know, a hotbed of, unfortunately, violence and politics, you know, thinking about Harold Washington, the first black mayor, you know, who was like, that was like our Barack Obama before, you know, decades before, you know, Barack came on the scene. But even though it is a hotbed of violence and politics, it's also, I think, the city is also a beautiful example of family coming together and depending on each other, you know, making it through adversity, come what may. Even though times seem very challenging, you don't know if you can make it or not. And that kind of leads me probably to my last film that I had on the list here that I want to discuss, which was Soul Food. That came out in 1997, and that starred Nia Long, who was in Love Jones. Nia Long played Bird, by the way, the younger sister of three. Then there was the middle sister played by Vivica A. Fox, Maxine. And then the oldest sister was played by Vanessa Williams. Forgive me, I can't remember what her name, but she was the oldest sister. So Soul Food came out in 1997. And what was so significant about this film is it's about three sisters, and they're trying to take care of their ailing mom, played by Irma P. Hall. They called her Big Mama. And it was one of the first films where you kind of saw, they weren't a poor family. They were like the typical black middle-class family in Chicago. I guess that's the best way I can describe it. And it kind of reminded me of my family in a way. So my dad was married three times. So I kind of go, take it this right route. In his first marriage, he had eight kids. He got divorced, married my mom, and had my older sister and I. And then when I was like in college, my parents got divorced and he married his third or final wife. And I have a brother who's about 10 years younger than me. So even though he had a total of 11 kids, you know, we weren't raised as half brothers. You know, we were brothers and sisters.
Wow.
And, you know, I called my older siblings Mom Mabel. They called my mom, you know, Mom Betty, you know. And the same thing with my younger sibling, you know. And Soul Food kind of reminded me of that, you know, it's like everybody's off doing their own thing, you know, they're each sibling and a family member is in a different profession or what have you. Some are being successful, some are not, but what keeps you going, especially if you're having a rough time in life, it's nothing like coming to that big house that the patriarch or the matriarch have, you know, and going in the kitchen. I didn't participate, but I remember sitting in the kitchen and watching my sisters or even my woman cousins, you know, with my parents and grandparents, grandmother and my mom, making that big meal for Easter or Christmas. We had that big 4th of July gathering, you know, barbecue or whatever. And just watching the art of making macaroni and cheese and biscuits and, you know, cooking collard greens and, I mean, just the peach cobbler. There was an art to it. And, and while they're cooking, they're talking about, you know, oh, did you hear what happened to cousin so-and-so or Uncle Joe, you know. And to me, Soul Food captured the essence of that type of family that I grew up in.
It's interesting because you mentioned earlier the Great Migration that brought so many people from the South to Chicago and, you know, other places like Detroit. And they came to New York, too. But I think the way the country is situated, it's almost like a straight shot up from the heart of the South right up to Chicago. And, you know, those Southern cooking traditions and family, I mean, it's special everywhere, but I think there's something to be said for that film being set in Chicago. And then when the camera pans across the table with all that food, good God.
Yes, yes. The producer of that movie, George Tillman Jr., I believe. So Soul Food was so successful, I think it made, like, domestically $94 million. But that kind of opened up the door for more films of that nature. You know, we start seeing the one that just off the top of my head is This Christmas. I think it was produced by the same guy. And, you know, other films, like, you know, not the struggling good times, you know, struggling to get out the project film, but family that, you know, everyday working class, middle class families, you know, who may be living paycheck to paycheck. Some of them may not. They might be living better than that, you know. And how, you know, life presents challenges to different family members. You get mad at them, you get angry at them, but eventually
and
you come together
at the end of the day. Yes, yeah,
exactly. Especially when the matriarch or the patriarch, where in this case the matriarch gets sick, because the mom was, I believe she was diabetic, and of course she passes in the film, and it just kind of throws the whole family into disarray for a while. And sisters are not speaking to each other, family members aren't speaking to each other. There's I think there was a incident of infidelity with a cousin.
Yes.
You know. But
yes.
And just seeing, and then it was a big fire in the family's house, and just when you think, okay, you know, everything's going to shit, you know, nothing's going to be right again, here comes the uncle who never speaks, you know, who finds this hidden treasure, and that was like almost like the fitting in of to the film, you know.
Exactly. That's a very good choice. And I was going to wrap up with one more film, but now I feel like the film that you mentioned is so family oriented. And what I was going to bring in is a cop comedy.
No, go ahead, please.
I don't know how many people remember this movie. It wasn't necessarily a blockbuster, but I watched it again last night and I really enjoyed it. It's called Running Scared. It's from the 80s again, 1987. I don't know why my Chicago movie favorites are from the 80s. Maybe that's when more movies about the Chicago were made, or maybe when I started noticing them more. You know, apart from the really old classic movies from, you know, maybe the 50s or the 60s. But again, this is called Running Scared, and it's about a pair of detectives played by the late Gregory Hines, who I love, and Billy Crystal, who's, you know, comedian, much liked. He's funny, he's amiable, but I loved Gregory Hines. He just could do everything. He could act, he could sing, he could do drama, he could do comedy. So it was sort of like a, you know, a buddy comedy drama. And the whole thing is shot in Chicago during the winter. And you can see that they are freaking cold through this whole movie. So basically, these two guys are cracking jokes the whole time while they're trying to run down this drug kingpin who's played by Jimmy Smith in like one of his first film roles. So it's the 80s, so he's really young. They're all really young. The movie kind of has the feel of like Lethal Weapon, which was Mel Gibson and Danny Glover together, but that Lethal Weapon kind of did it a little bit better. But like the whole intro, before the action even starts and you see the credits come up, they're giving you visually this entire tour of Chicago, like downtown and the river and the Chicago, what's the newspaper? The Chicago, not the Defender, which I know is a paper, but Sun-Times building. And those circular apartment buildings, and they're showing you Wrigley Field, and they're showing you like everything about Chicago in the winter, covered by snow. And you've also got like a lot of great actors in it. It's got Joe Pantoliano, I don't know if you know him, who always plays like this smart mouth, wise guy. It's got Dan Hedaya, who always plays like a police captain who's harried. And, you know, you guys, this is your last chance. You guys think you're funny. You're going to get kicked out of the force if you don't do blah, blah, blah. You know, all these cop movies are the same, right? And, you know, Billy Crystal and Gregory Hines have a lot of chemistry. And, you know, there's gunfire and double crosses and wisecracks and dead bodies. But it's not a great movie, but it's super entertaining. So if anybody's interested in Running Scared, it's on HBO Max. And, oh, the other thing about it is it's got great 80s era music. Like, the entire soundtrack is mostly by Rod Temperton, who was a member of Heatwave and went on to pen all those monster hits for Michael Jackson and Quincy Jones, all the Off the Wall hits.
Yeah, he was a founding member of Heatwave, too. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there's a song in the film that I really love that goes, "Oh, sweet freedom." And
yeah, Michael McDonald.
Great,
yeah.
Yep, it's just a great Michael McDonald song from that movie. So I'll just add that.
I remember that song. I don't remember the movie that well, but when you start singing that song, I could see like clips of the film.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a great song. There's other really good songs, but there's some trashy songs in it too. But it's a really good soundtrack. So I recommend the movie. And there's other films that I could get to, like, you know, Adventures in Babysitting, you know, High Fidelity.
Oh, wow.
The Sting, which, you know, goes between Chicago and New York, Gross Point Blank. But I'll just leave it where it is.
Oh, let me just mention one thing really quick that I thought about.
Please do.
And I'm mentioning it quick because it's a movie about Chicago and someone who's very dear to the Chicago community, especially the African-American community. But it wasn't filmed in Chicago, but it has to be mentioned. And that's Judas and the Black Messiah, the movie about Fred Hampton. Oh, my God. So it was filmed in Cleveland, actually. Cleveland actually caught the nuances and the character of Chicago in the 1960s when, you know, that's when Fred Hampton was at the top of his game. Chairman Fred Hampton, I should say, the Illinois Black Panther Party. And
yes.
I actually know his son, Fred Hampton Jr. And Fred Hampton Jr. and Fred Hampton's mom were actually on the set. They let them be on the set, and, you know, and kind of give the mom, of course, he would Fred Hampton Jr. was a baby in his mom's stomach during most of that time that the film was set. You know, but of course, you can relate the stories that his mom told him. You know, so the film is very accurate, is what I'm getting at. And I think Daniel,
Hallelujah.
Yeah, he had the dialect, the body language, the mannerisms of Fred Hampton down to the core. And also, unfortunately, the brother who played the Judas,
Lakeith Stanfield.
Yes, phenomenal actor, to the point where everyone I know who saw that film, they hated him, and they had to do their best. Okay, we got to separate the character who was, you know, from the actor. You know, they wanted to hate the actor because he was so phenomenal in that film. But if you look at the footage, there's this old documentary called Eyes on the Prize, and the real Judas, can't think of the real guy's name, the real guy who portrayed Fred Hampton, I think, like, just after he filmed that documentary, just within a month, he committed suicide. The weight of what he did, he could not live with himself. But anyway, it is a Chicago movie, but it wasn't filmed in Chicago. But you can't talk about Chicago and the Black community and the struggle, or talk about how you can't really talk about Black Lives Matter, in my opinion, and the protests there and the struggles that we're going through now, you are going through now, without looking at like the life of Fred Hampton and some of the other Black Panthers, you know. Because it's almost like history repeating itself. And the thing about Fred Hampton is, and I think this is what got him killed, he wasn't just reaching out to the Black community. He went to the Appalachians, you know, and talked to the white people who lived in the Appalachians. He talked to Hispanic people. He was really the first Rainbow Coalition, if you will, you know, that made certain people like Hoover consider him a dangerous man. But anyway, I had to throw that film out there.
Thank you so much for that. And that is an interesting point. I didn't think of it from that perspective.
Chicago, Chicago, that toddling town. Chicago, Chicago, I'll show you around. I love it.
So you bring the politics of Chicago, the history of Chicago, the Black culture of Chicago to bear in, you know, including that film. So I really do thank you for joining me. And, you know, this has been enlightening. Yeah.
All right. Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure. I enjoyed myself. Let's do it again.
Let's do it again.
Hey, thanks for listening to another edition of the Words on Flicks show. I hope you enjoyed the conversation between myself and journalist extraordinaire Demetrius Patterson as we talked about Chi-Town in the movies. Man, now I really want to go to Chicago. I haven't been there in years. I need me some deep dish pizza and a Chicago dog, man. Anyway, next month in August, we're taking a little hiatus, summer break, if you will. So I'll see you back here in September. So be safe, be well, peace and blessings. See you next time. So long.